Ja, hallo, hier ist Felicia Herrschaft heute mit einer Axiom-Sendung und zwar zum Thema 68. Und zwar lote ich in dieser Sendung aus, inwiefern, was man unter 68 heute verstehen kann, ausgehend eben von einer Konferenz, die in Prag im Mai diesen Jahres stattgefunden hat. Und anhand dieser Konferenz werde ich eben dann auch Bezug nehmen auf die 68er in einem Gespräch mit Lauren Langman, der eben die 68er als eine Bewegung, als eine soziale Bewegung auch ansieht, aber auch versucht zu beschreiben, wie diese Bewegung, wie diese 68er in dem Sinne bestimmte Resultate jetzt auch immer noch in dieser Gesellschaft dann zeigen, um eben auch soziale Bewegungen dann heute zu verstehen. Bei dieser Konferenz 2008 in Prag haben zum Beispiel Nancy Fraser und auch Su Suiming gesprochen. Und diese beiden Vorträge werde ich jetzt gleich spielen. Zuerst den von Su Suiming. Sie ist Professorin in China an der Chinese Academy of Social Science in Peking. Und diese Universität oder Akademie zeigt eben, ist sozusagen situiert im Feld der Philosophie und der Social Science. Und gleichzeitig ist es ein National Center of Comprehensive Studies in the People's Republic of China. Und Su Suiming nimmt Bezug in ihrem Vortrag auf 68 in China, etwas, das hier eigentlich wenig bekannt ist. Und das wird dann auch in dem Gespräch mit Lauren Langman nochmal thematisiert. Nancy Fraser hat einen Vortrag gehalten über 1968 and the cunning of history und hat dann aber nicht auf Hillary, sondern auf Barack Obama Bezug genommen. Und da gibt es dann auch wiederum Bezüge in dem, was Lauren Langman dann in der zweiten Stunde auch zu Obama sagen wird und welche Konsequenzen das haben kann, wenn Obama möglicherweise im November diesen Jahres als Präsident der USA gewählt werden sollte. Jetzt also zu dem Gespräch mit Su Suiming, ihren Vortrag in Prag.
China. History, a reflection and reality.
Speak up, yeah, louder.
Oh, mm-hmm. After 20 years of golden ages, the Western youth of the post-war generation launched a rebel in the mid of 1960s. From then on, this rebel opened the prelude of 14 years new social movements, NSMS. At the same time, China took place unprecedented cultural revolution, CCR. Maybe. Mm-hmm. The Eastern and Western rebel tides almost arose in the meantime, changing the post-war political landscape. The inheritance of this age is called the 60 spirit in the West. How should we treat such Eastern and Western revolutions in 1960s? I try analyzing Chinese factors, how to affect Western new social movements, explaining the different properties and characteristics of these two movements, exploring new social movements, how to affect the contemporary China. One, history serving Chinese factor in the rise of new social movements. Above all, let's look back some important in historical events in 1966 to 1968. In May of 1966, the Central Committee of Communist Party of China announced May 16 information which symbolized Chinese cultural revolution to start formally. May of 1966, German Frankfurt University, the student, held an anti-war meeting. After that, and held a huge demonstration. These things you are very similar. Yesterday after yesterday, the movies may maybe showed a lot of the atmosphere at that time. In January of 1967, Italy took place a student rebel movement. In October of 1967, many people held a huge anti-war demonstration in Washington. April 4th of 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King was killed. Since then, American civil rights movements and the student movements were raised to a new stage. In May of 1968, the student in Paris went into the street holding large-scale demonstrations and destructive activities. Mainstorm marked the tip of the Western youth rebel movement. Anyway, in 1960s, the whole world was feeling the atmosphere of the liberation of revolution. Actually, Chinese events in the 1960s become one of the origins of the Western Revolution currents. Practically, the rebel activities of Chinese Red Guard movements, I think, set a direct symbol for the Western youth. They are radical actions of down with all authorities, stirred up the romantic emotions and imaginations of the Western youth greatly. Spiritually, Mao Zedong, who fought against both imperialism and revisionism, became the adoration of the Western youth. Mao, Marcus, and Marx were named the 3M at that time, become thinking engines of the Western youth. The resonance of Eastern and Western revolutions in 1960s expressed a protest to stable orders together. Both of them protest against the traditional education systems, opposed giving bureaucratic systems, opposed the hegemony of imperialism, refused the dogma of Soviet Marxism, and take various Marxism as their rebel banners, and so on. Maybe including Cuba, Guerrilla, and so on. In a world, ocean overflows a strong feeling of counter-elitism, counter-knowledge, counter-culture in this protest. Both Eastern and Western youth put into a cultural rebelling posture. Two, serious reflection and analysis of relations between new social movements and China cultural revolution. Is there any inherent relations between the Western and Eastern revolution in 1960s? My reply is no. Both of them are two different events that happened in different places at the same time. New social movements that appear in the 1960s is a new mode of the social movements. Different from traditional socialist labor movements, newness of new social movements is reflecting those discontents of post-war Western new generations of minting class in the end of a prosperity period, which is a new mode of cultural protest and rebel movements that new social subject treat post war new contradictions with new values. First, the intrinsic reasons of new social movements reveal their particularities, reflecting a lot of new social conflicts in the post-war West. Unlike the socialist labor movement's struggle for the for economy and political liberation, a new social movement is new protest caused by such new contradictions of modernization between an economical growth and environment crisis, scientific progress and human alienation. Second, the subjects of new social movements are new social stratums who come from changes of post-war economical social structures lately. Members of new social movements chiefly are young and educated new minting class. Also include some marginal people. New social movement represent their new discontents and new claims principally. Third, new social movements has new values and new struggle targets. Unlike traditional socialist labor movements that take class struggle as a foundation and take labor liberation as target, and new social movements has its specific values orientation, focus, protest themes, organize the modes, and mobilize the means. The particular the participants of new social movements emphasize the values of post-materialism, concern post-materialism issues. Fourth, new social movements present new forms and characteristics of a movement. Unlike the organized identical collective of traditional socialist labor movements, new social movements has no tight organization and class attribute. It is non-class and centered. Example, movements, famine movements, a peaceful peace movement, anti-racism movements, and the third world anti-economical imperialism movements make off five basic forms of new social movements. So the English scholar Lawrence Weld called the new social movements as either new complaints rose from economical and political rationalization of growing expectations and changing value choice of wealthy societies. In contrast with new social movements, China, a cultural revolution, isn't intrinsic requirements of historical process. It's only a produce of a person will. In a way, it is a factitious detractions and abnormal rupture for Chinese modernization process. Politically, different from 1968 revolution, Chinese Cultural Revolution isn't a mass movement that come into being from bottom to top spontaneously, but a factitious movement that controlled by the top power from above to the below of the rebels. Different from 1968 revolution that performed a new various orientation, China's cultural revolution doesn't represent any new value principles, a new struggle tactics. On the contrary, in strengthening premiership of Stalin mood across the board. This is not a historical advancement, but a historical can't match. Though the type of Western 1960s revolution is gone, but the 1968's inherent basis and social foundations, its new forms and new values still exist. The anti-nuclear movement, anti-war movement, ecological movement, famine movement in 70s to 80s, and anti-globalization movements in 90s to now represent its new development, maybe include the civil disobedience movements, maybe include this. New social movements has already become the most extensively varied social movements in contemporary West. Contrary, the government and public in China become a political consensus that denied Chinese cultural revolution. Namely, they believe cultural revolution is not a good choice for China. Cultural revolution has no future. Therefore, the meeting of both Western and Eastern two movement in 60s is an accidental, and the 2-1 are incomparable. New social movement is an inevitable revolution, and China cultural revolution is a man-made fake revolution. 3. Reality thinking. And new social movement and contemporary China. From the beginning of 1980s, various Western new Marxism theories began enter China, especially front of schools thinking and so on. Chinese scholars got some ideas of new social movements indirectly from these streams. After 1990s, theories of new social movements also start to be familiar to the Chinese. After 30 years of high-speed development, China is situated in similar social context of the West in the 60s, I think. Thus, the reflections about new social movement provided the rich theoretical resources for contemporary China. First, at the social level, new social movement reflect the post-war profound changes of the Western social structure, witness of the emergence of the subject, and ask for strengthening the social construction, expanding the civil base of the modernization in order to actualize a new social integration. In a way, 1968 movements is a total eruption of the Western social contradiction that accumulated in the post-war 20 years. After 30 years removed, the Chinese society transits quickly from a single status to a multiple status. New social subject emerging continually. This silent alteration of social structure is unprecedented in the several thousand years of China history. Currently, China is facing various social contradictions, both old and new. It's very easy to bring the society on conflict. 1968 movements show the ignoring new social strengths and their new claims will lead to serious situations. China must pay great attention to new social subjects and their claims, carrying out a new social integration. Second, at a cultural level, new social movements represented new waves of post-war new social subjects, shaping new multicultural claims, asking for expanding various horizons, extending cultural tolerance in order to promote civic participate the democracy. In essence, new social movement is a struggle for multicultural powers. Such cultural protests explain well, carrying our new social integration to demand new cultural values. In post-1968, multiculturalism ideas has gradually become one of the cultural values foundations. Nowadays,
go to the conclusion, please. Yeah.
China must draw multicultural ideas from new social movements, constituting a new various basis. The third, at the political level, new social movements developing the new mode civil disobedience, politically changing and strengthening post-war Western systems in order to present objective demands of deepen political restrictions and expanding participatory democracy. The most important achievement of 1968 movements is the development of a participatory democracy. And the greatest reaction is the resulting in social unrest. China needs to develop people's participatory democracy principally, make great effort to develop grassroots democracy, promoting political restructuring.
Ja, heute in dieser Axiom-Sendung war das ein erster Vortrag mit einem Blick auf die Kulturrevolution in China und wie jetzt möglicherweise demokratische und partizipatorische Aspekte der chinesischen Regierung oder in China zu erkennen sind von Su Yiming. Und jetzt im Anschluss folgt ein Vortrag von Nancy Fraser eben über 1968 and the Cunning of History. Und sie wird das auch nochmal kontextualisieren, in welcher Weise oder in welchem Kontext man sich genau in dieser Session in Prag 2008 befunden hat.
It's fascinating to share the platform with these two speakers. And it really makes me very conscious of how parochial the perspective that I'm going to present is, how, well, I can't even say Western in the sense of European, but how American it is. But I do think that it's interesting that both of the previous speakers posed a question which is central for my own reflections, namely the question of the legacy of 68. What do we inherit? What are the traces that are left in our world for better or for worse? And that is the central question that motivates me here. I'm also very interested in the idea that the developments, on the one hand, in the Czech Republic and in China, as you've both pointed out, are obviously in many ways quite separate from and distinct from the events that I'm going to be reflecting on. On the other hand, there are all these very interesting borrowings, you know, the images of the American students waving the copies of the Red Book and so on, and of course, the borrowings of neoliberal economic shock therapy. So however separate these things are, they communicate in some way that is important for us to understand. Okay, so my question then is what is left, shall we say, of 1968? What is left of what I would describe as an enormous explosion of democratizing energies that were premised on something that seems far away from us now, namely the confident hope that the direct action of ordinary people in civil society could produce emancipatory social change on a very broad scale. That seems quite far away from the present. And I want to use the occasion here to kind of reflect on what 68 has left to us. In the interest of full disclosure, I have to say that I was myself a participant in some of the events of that momentous year and in the ensuing political struggles set in motion. These were life-changing experiences for me, experiences that very much made me who I am. And I would have to say that for me, they are not really even past. They shape my thinking to this day. In fact, I think I could say that for my whole academic and intellectual career, I have been writing and thinking about nothing else than what is left of 1968. My own work on redistribution and recognition is in part a meditation on that question. And as some of you know, I sought to answer the question, what is left, by theorizing what I called an epical shift in the grammar of political claims making from redistribution to recognition. And I just want to point out that that formula encapsulates an entire complex story about what is left of 1968. It's a story that endorses the emancipatory thrust of new left efforts to expand the social democratic imaginary, the imaginary that governs political culture in the United States, and I would say in much of Western Europe in the post-war period, an imaginary that was oriented largely to problems of economic inequality and to class, and thereby marginalized non-economic harms and non-class subjects. My story also then, of course, valorizes the New Left as opening the prospect of a larger, more expansive radical democratic imaginary that could aim to combat simultaneously two analytically distinct kinds of harms, resource inequality and status hierarchy. But it's a story that, in a sense, observes the failure in the end to actually realize this new integrated radical political imaginary as the cultural turn, in my view, gets transformed from a needed corrective to reductive economism in the social democratic imaginary into a totalizing culturalist ideology that turns out to be every bit as reductive and one-sided as the one it sought to correct. So I am observing then the transformation of the new social movements in the United States into variants of identity politics, albeit rather progressive ones, which repress the critique of political economy, economy, and which therefore dovetail all too neatly with neoliberalism emerging as it arose from the dustbin of history. So I concluded, in effect, that the New Left, New Social Movement project had been derailed, in a sense, hijacked by an instance of this cunning of history in my title, and that an orientation that was unambiguously emancipatory in one context, that is the context of the étatiste, paternalistic post-war social democracy, turned into its opposite in another context, that of emergent neoliberalism. So, of course, that's a very discouraging, disheartening story of the cutting of history and of the recuperation of some of the 1968 aspirations into an emergent post-Fordist neoliberal capitalism. Now, interestingly, that story resonates in certain ways with the one told by Luke Boltanski and Eve Ciapolo in their important book, The New Spirit of Capitalism. They make the profound and, I think, original argument that one cannot separate capitalism from the critique of capitalism, that capitalism lives off of its critique, that it needs a spirit to legitimate itself and to motivate the engagement of new generations, and that it often finds that new spirit in the counter-systemic movements of the preceding era. So Boltanski and Ciapolo argue that the spirit that is informing and enabling the new flexible capitalism of our time has been fashioned from some of the emotional and ideational materials of May 68, especially from what they call the artistic critique of that time, the critique that is best expressed in the slogan, l'imagination du pouvoir. This is a variant, let us say, of alienation critique as opposed to exploitation or injustice critique, which faults capitalism for its stunting of individual creativity and freedom, for its gray conformism, its soul-destroying tract housing and office cubicles, imagine, you know, the films of Jean-Luc Godard, its bureaucratized normalizing routines. This artistic critique of capitalism was part of the New Left, maybe it was even the new part of the New Left, but it went hand in hand, at least for a while, as we saw in the, some of us in the film two nights ago, with a more familiar justice critique that had been associated with the old left, the working class movements, the trade unions. So French auto workers felt enough kinship with student surrealists to transform the latter's protests into a general strike that came close to bringing down the French government. However, in Boltanski and Ciapolo's story, the two critiques go their separate ways, much as in my story, the redistribution recognition, go their separate ways, And this is where their story gets really interesting. The artistic critique gets taken up by the new management theorists who use it to criticize the Fordist model of corporate organization and to develop a post-Fordist project capitalism in which rigid organizational hierarchies are supplanted by horizontal teams, in which fixed rule-governed work discipline gives way to self-managed discretionary practice. And so the imagination and freedom that moved the 68ers is now appropriated to effect a romance of a new form of capitalism to attract the talents and energies of new middle-class students. So this is another version, right, of a cunning of a history story in which what is left of the new left is flexible post-Fordist capitalism. I want to mention two more structurally similar narratives of recuperation. These are all narratives of recuperation. One is the idea that the new left critique of welfare state paternalism gets recuperated for the neoliberal critique, this is something I wrote about years ago, of welfare dependency, which eventually in the United States led to the end of welfare as we know it, that is to the abolition of entitlements to income support and to the shift to conditioned time-limited support, which was basically a return to the old poor law model of aid to the poor. So an ideology of personal responsibility, here too then, a freedom theoretic critique of 68 ends up providing grist for the mill of welfare state retrenchment. Finally, and this is to me one of the most disturbing of such narratives, the feminist critique of the family wage is recuperated for a transition to post-Fordist flexibilization in another sense. That is, it could be that when all is said and done, maybe I'm being hyperbolic, the most lasting legacy of second wave feminism will have been to provide the legitimation to a form of capitalism very heavily increasingly reliant on women's wage labor and the two-family earner and so on. So, yes, so the lasting achievement of second-wave feminism will have been to legitimate that transition from a Fordist mode of accumulation premised on male manufacturing employment that pays something close to a family wage to a post-Fordist mode of accumulation, which some want to call Walmartism, premised on more gender egalitarian flex forms like temping, moonlighting, subcontracting, and so on, in which the average hours of paid work per household is skyrocketing, even as real wages decline. Now that brings me to Hillary. Hillary, at this point, Hillary Clinton, whose campaign, it seems to me, is essentially finished. Nevertheless, her absolutely most reliable base of support is among white, ethnic, working class women who are not ideologically feminist, many and never had any actual connection with the feminist movement in any organized ideological sense, many of whom might have even refused the label feminism, but who have an extremely powerful gender identification with Hillary Clinton. By contrast, virtually every ideological feminist that I know deserted Hillary Clinton many months ago and have been, you know, solidly behind the campaign of Barack Obama. But this is an extremely interesting turnaround, which I think we're only beginning now to understand. But put it this way, the women who are Clinton's base of support are women who live the Walmart life of the new flexible capitalism at the, right, the low end. They are not the two-earner professional family women. They are people who are extremely embattled and beleaguered in their lives, and they identify with someone who they see as having been embattled and beleaguered, humiliated repeatedly over and over by her husband's sexual adventures, knocked down politically over and over and over again, but it's this that they identify with, but who has grit, right? Who is kind of comes back and fights. Now, this is what her campaign, I think, represented was the idea that of a return to something like the Fordist welfare state model. Or maybe it's Fordism light. I mean, it's not a real return. But this model that the state and a trusted fighting politician like her would revive a certain kind of paternalistic quasi-social democratic regime, and in that way solve problems for these beleaguered people. This is a very there's very little left of the new left here at all. By contrast, the campaign of Barack Obama, I want to say, this is sort of despite these pessimistic, disheartening stories of recuperation that I've been telling, which I believe are true, actually, I'm not disclaiming them. Nevertheless, it seems to me that the campaign of Barack Obama does draw on some crystals in the Benjaminian sense, right? Some buried New Left treasures that have are lying around somehow waiting to be reactivated. The story that I'm trying to tell here is a story of recuperation of New Left aspirations through splitting. The splitting of recognition from redistribution, the incorporation by capitalism of the first, the displacement of the second, the splitting of the artistic critique from the social critique, the recuperation of the first, the displacement of the second, and the splitting of the critique of gender hierarchy from the critique of capitalism, the incorporation of a version of the first, the displacement of the other. So the question is, where are the split-off fragments? Are they still present anywhere in forms that can be reactivated, that can be reconnected to the counterpart aspirations, some of which have found other incarnations? And call me naive, but I do think that my phrase for the one word for where these things are now is Obama, and that's a signifier. It's not the name of a human being, as I'm using it, who will certainly disappoint us in many ways. But it is the floating signifier of a. An effort to imagine the sort of reactivation and reuniting of the split-off fragments and crystals of these aspirations that have otherwise been tossed aside in the recuperative process. So,
okay. Well, thank you very much.
Nancy, very much like the way you now proposed the last part of the presentation of using Obama's signifier in a very similar manner as Ernesto Laclau uses the idea of populist or populism and the leader as a signifier, never like fulfilling the claims of people, because in the actual reality it's a separate thing. So I really enjoyed that. The second thing I want to ask is, well, if you have to say something about this kind of relationship of Laclau, and your view of the signifier. But the second thing I wanted to say is that though I share much of the criticism of Lut Boltanski and Yves Chapello in the Nouveau Spirit of Capitalism, I somehow have the feeling, and I have the feeling all the time, that there was some conservative view of the notion of revolution that they both have. And that there was a nostalgic air, an aspiration or whatever, that I thought that in your view changes a lot that perspective, because what I thought that you did is bringing back the problem of equality to the thematization of justice without having to recover the Marxist things that they want to. And they still believe that there is a possibility of thinking of a super trans class or something like that. And that's the part that I say is somehow nostalgic, somehow conservative.
Oh, no,
that's
Sandro.
Yes.
And
I'll go around. So, Liz, I like your reconstruction, your three-pronged reconstruction. One question I have is on the first point, post-Fordism view of management, whether, in fact, it doesn't actually predate Antecedents 68. You presented it as a sort of incorporation, absorption, or certain aesthetic elements of the 68 revolution, but it goes back to 1928, Elton Mayo and the human potential, and you know, Drucker, Likert, and Maslow, who wrote independently in the 50s, some of them in the 50s, and some of them in the early 60s, independent, completely independent. But the idea of a the logic, a view of management, which is post-Fordism, actually precedes post-Fordism in the sense of the line, the assembly line. It starts the rigidity of speaking of the rigidity of organizations. The idea that discipline is the key to the functioning of the organization, and so on. And the second point is about the split of fragments, and we talked about this informally earlier. Whether some of this, I agree with your analysis that they cluster now. Obama is the one who has more potential for bringing at least some of them together. But I worry whether some of this split off fragments of the spirit of 68 haven't actually gone all the way, all the board, all across the board to the other side. And I refer especially to a kind of iconoclastic clash of the low and the high, a kind of attempt to poke through the stuffiness of institutional forms and make fun of them, and the sense of provocation of the surrealist kind of spirit. And we have observed that over the past 20 and more years, more often on the right, on the conservative side. Think of the way the role of president has been acted up by Reagan, or think of Sarkozy now, or even a character like Berlusconi. Some of that spirit is more to the right, and the left appears to be sort of stuffy and boring roles. Now, maybe the present presidential competition in the U.S. doesn't have that risk. But in the past, this has been a problem. The left appears much more stuffy and boring than the right.
Thanks to both of you. Yes, I hadn't read McLeod's book on populism, but I know some of his earlier writings about this issue of empty signifiers. And I do have very much that analysis of the empty signifier in mind here. And I'm quite sympathetic to his and Move's account of hegemony. I have many other differences with them, which are too numerous to list here. But I believe that one can take those ideas from Move to Lacan, the notion of the discursive articulation of hegemony and the role of an empty signifier in enabling that. I think you can take that without buying into all sorts of other problematic notions that they hold. I don't know what to say about your claim that Boltanski and Chaplow are, have a kind of conservative nostalgia for Marxism. I think I would try to defend them, actually, against that, but that's not really central to the story that I want to tell here. I do think that their book is oddly has two severe limitations, and maybe this connects to your thought. One is that it is so exclusively focused on the structure of employment that it really neglects any serious view of changes in family and gender order, which are absolutely tightly interwoven, and you can't possibly understand the changes in work without also this. And then the other thing is that it's oddly, you know, French. Considering this transition to flex capitalism, which, you know, open borders and so on and so forth, there's something very national about the analysis. And that takes me to Sandra's point. Again, you know, in invoking Boltanski Chaplow, I didn't necessarily need to endorse every claim that they make. I really wanted to introduce it as I'm just struck by the fact that we have all of these rather seemingly powerful narratives of recuperation, which involve this kind of splitting in ways that my own view is like that in a structural way. It's possible, though, that even if you're right that management theory of this kind can be found much earlier, if they could still be right at the same time in claiming that what gives it resonance at this point and gives it the capacity to create a new romance of capitalism, what they mean is a new spirit of capitalism, is the connection with 68. And I would say that from the standpoint of the U.S. situation, I would agree with them. If you just look at Silicon Valley, and you know, you just see how a whole generation of kids who, you know, a couple decades ago would have been in the street smoking dope, new left activists, are kind of, writing software code in their garages, and I mean, it's the same. There's something. I think there's something right about this notion of an affinity here with this youth part of the dot-com startup thing, and that takes me then to the last point about the split-off fragments. And, well, yes, there is the theatricality dimension, the surrealism dimension. Of course, you can find that across the board. Maybe what is what we haven't sort of made central enough, though, is the sort of the Port Huron moment. Participatory democracy, which was the central sort of, I would claim, the aspiration in the U.S. New Left, which was sort of the core that radiated out to everything else, even though it was actually quickly swamped by, and this gets to Zunin's presentation, swamped by all this silly aping of, you know, the trappings of Maoism and so on and so forth. But there was that participatory democratic vision, and that seems to be the, you know, a remaining crystal that is very central in the Obama phenomenon.
Ja, aus Zeitgründen können wir jetzt doch nicht die ganze Diskussion noch hören. Und zwar war das zu Nancy Frasers Vortrag, eben auch zu 1968. Und um noch mal kurz Nancy Fraser vorzustellen, sie ist Henry A. and Louis Loeb, Professor of Political and Social Science an der New School of Social Research in New York. Sie konzentriert sich in ihrer Forschung auf Social and Political Theory, Feminist Theory, Contemporary French and German Thoughts. Einige der Veröffentlichungen hat sie selber auch in ihrem Vortrag genannt, aber ich kann sie nochmal nennen: Redistribution or Recognition, a Political Philosophical Exchange, co-authored with Axel Honneth. Und das ist auch in Deutsch erschienen im Surkamp Verlag. Und dann The Radical Imagination Between Redistribution and Recognition. Sie ein Book in Progress ist Post-National Democratic Justice. Und jetzt gleich in der zweiten Stunde spreche ich mit Lauren Langman, den ich auch gleich vorstellen werde.